Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. Our Halloween special episode sees guest Kimberly Pierce join me to discuss William Castle and his 1959 feature, House on Haunted Hill.
I'm Vincent Price, and you're invited to my party in the House on Haunted Hill, where so far the ghosts have murdered only 7 people. So won't you come and make it 8? You'll see human heads without bodies. Mysterious pools of blood dripping from the ceiling. The walls move slowly in against you. Don't try to escape, you can't.
William Castle wanted to be a horror director at the age of 13, after seeing Bela Lugosi and Dracula on stage. After meeting the legendary Lugosi, Castle said, quote, "I knew then what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to scare the pants off audiences." At just 15, he dropped out of high school to join the Dracula Touring Company as an assistant stage manager. His first attempt at finding a gimmick was the result of leasing a Connecticut theater from Orson Welles, of all people. After hiring German actress Ellen Schwanecke for a non-existent play, he sent out a fictional telegram to local newspapers, alerting them that the actress had turned down a request to go to Munich and perform for the Nazis. He also secretly vandalized the theater, painting swastikas outside of it to further the ruse. I doubt it would work so well today. It worked, though, at the time, and the play, written in just 48 hours, was a smash success, proving to Castle that finding a gimmick was the road to success.
Now, before the party begins, let's go over the details. The caretakers will leave at midnight, locking us in here until they come back in the morning. Once the door is locked, there's no way out. The windows have bars that a jail would be proud of, and the only door to the outside locks like a vault. There's no electricity, no phone, no one within miles, so no way to call for help.
Like a coffin.
Castle left the stage for Hollywood at the tender age of 23. He got a job with Harry Cohn of Columbia Pictures and was cited as one of the few people friendly with the mogul. He started out making B-films, his first being the 1943 movie The Chance of a Lifetime. He later directed 4 of the popular Whistler series. As Castle moved up the ranks, he soon amassed a reputation for making films quickly and under budget. Yet Castle wasn't happy. He wanted to make his own movies, so he struck out on his own. His first movie, 1958's Macabre, was inspired by the French film Diabolique. And if you want to hear my thoughts on Diabolique, go back and listen to episode 7 of Ticklish Biz. Mortgaging his house, the first but not the last time he would, the movie became a hit. It was also the first time Castle implemented his legendary gimmicks to a wide audience, offering them $1,000 life insurance policies from Lloyd's of London.
Why all these strangers? Why none of our friends?
Friends? Do we have any friends?
No, your jealousy took care of that.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section. From psychiatrist to typist, and from drunk to jet pilot. They share one thing, they all need money. Now let's see if they're brave enough to earn it.
Castle's next film was perhaps his best known, 1959's The House on Haunted Hill. The Vincent Price star was reminiscent of countless old dark house features that dominated in the 1930s, and was considered somewhat passé by this point. The movie marked his first collaboration with actor Vincent Price, as well as character actor Elisha Cook Jr. For House on Haunted Hill's release, Castle created a Murgo, a skeleton with red-lit eyes that floated over audiences on a wire during the film's finale. Unlike other gimmicks, this one tended to result in rowdy teenagers attempting to pull the skeleton down or otherwise attack it during screenings. But regardless, on a budget of just $200,000, House on Haunted Hill grossed over $1.5 million.
Now, I'm going to knock on the other wall. When you hear me, you knock on this wall. Tap lower down.
Castle kept the gimmicks rolling for over 10 years. Examples included Percepto and the Tingler, which were essentially joy buzzers for individual seats, Illusiono and 13 Ghosts, a take on 3D, and a punishment poll for the film Mr. Sardonicus, where audiences could decide what ending the film would have. Castle worked as a director until 1975, but his most accomplished film was one he never directed. In 1967, he mortgaged his home yet again to obtain the film rights to Ira Levin's Rosemary's Baby. He hoped that directing the horror picture would finally move him into prestige territory, but the studio behind it, Paramount, had different plans. They wanted and hired director Roman Polanski, breaking Castle's heart. He was forced into the role of producer, and a cameo as a man sitting outside a phone booth that Mia Farrow uses in the finished product. Despite the film's success and recognition, none of that fell back on its producer. Castle was left directing B Pictures for the rest of his career, and died of a heart attack on May 31, 1977. After the break, Kimberly Pierce joins me as we take a visit to the house on Haunted Hill.
The ghosts are moving tonight, restless, hungry. May I introduce myself? I'm Watson Pritchard. In just a minute, I'll show you the only really haunted house in the world. Since it was built a century ago, 7 people, including my brother, have been murdered in it. Since then, I've owned the house. I've only spent one night there, and when they found me in the morning, I was almost dead.
Today, listeners, we are doing our last Halloween episode on 1959's The House on Haunted Hill. My guest with me this week is the phenomenal Kimberly Pierce. Kimberly, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. Well, Kimberly, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and all the podcasting that you and I do in our free time, everything. So throw it out there.
Well, I am one of the 4 regulars on Citizen Dame that we drop every, what it's typically been every Wednesday. I've been a classic film fan since before I can remember. I also spend my time writing for Geek Girl Authority, do a little bit of film criticism for them, and I have a personal blog as well, KimberlyCPierce.com.
It's great that you were able to come on the podcast to talk about Vincent Price and The House on Haunted Hill. I saw this movie, I can't really remember. I probably saw the remake before I saw the original.
Really?
I tended to do that because I got into classic films in high school. So I tended to watch a lot of movies not knowing context. So I probably saw the remake before I saw the original. The remake came out in 99. So right around the anniversary of this. We'll talk about the remake in a bit. I went back and I saw this. William Castle is an interesting figure. His movies are all very entertaining, but they don't necessarily hold up to close film critic scrutiny. In a lot of ways, his films try to give you a twist, not necessarily a Hitchcock or a Kubrick type twist, but they play around a lot with genre. There's a seminal question that I want to throw out when we get to it about The House on Haunted Hill, because it starts out one way and then ends another way, but then adds at the very, very end, like literally in the final seconds, the possibility that might have been the first thing. It's all over the place, but you cannot deny that it's an entertaining movie with a really great cast of characters. So I enjoy it. But Kimberly, what's your background with this film?
I saw this film first. I was into classical film back when probably elementary school. Probably my first, you know, memory of watching older films is Hatari back probably when I was 5. So this movie I watched probably the first time in elementary school. I was probably a bit too young to have even seen it. And I just remember the scene with the blind woman coming out of the darkness and just remember being absolutely terrified of that.
There are a lot of really iconic scenes that this movie is often played in horror movies, like somebody's watching a television and it's sometimes this film. You have a really great pop culture infusion with this film. Most people have heard of it. Some people tend to get it confused. So this is not The Haunting, which is the Robert Wise film from 63, nor is this The Legend of Hell House from 73 with Roddy McDowall. I'd like to think there's a map of some of take a left on Elm Street, past The House on Haunted Hill, past The Haunting of Hell House. Let's talk about the plot in a nutshell. This tells the story of Frederick Lauren, who is one of the eccentric millionaires you hear about, played by Vincent Price. He invites a group of strangers to the legendary Hill House. I almost said Hell House. Where he offers each of them $10,000 if they can stay the night. Whoever doesn't, either because they leave or possibly end up being taken by the countless spirits that supposedly populate this place, the money will then be divided amongst whoever is left alive at the beginning of the next day. It's really just watching each of them get picked off one by one, trying to figure out what's going on. I find this to be a very fun movie, even though the plot is, it's a bit thin. The thing I want to bring up first, because I mentioned that this movie starts out one way, then segues into something else, and then goes back to that. Is this a murder mystery or a ghost story? The movie implies that it's a ghost story with all the spirits that live in Hill House, and you have Elisha Cook Jr.'s character, Watson Pritchett, who is telling everybody, he opens the film in this really funny floating heads type of thing, that there are so many spirits and they're, it's kind of the 99 happy haunts type of thing.
And perhaps they're coming for you.
Will you be the next one? But then it takes the segue into Frederick is using this possibly as a ruse to off his philandering wife, played by Carol Omart. And then it returns to, well, maybe the ghost did it. What do you consider this to be? A ghost story or a mystery?
I've always just classified it in my own head as a ghost story. However, in my most recent viewing, when I was, you know, thinking about it, the relationship element seems so much more prominent to me than it had in the past. Looking at the basis of the plot, thriller's the wrong word, the murder mystery aspect, I would say. It's just dangles in that ghost story element, not necessarily for the camp aspect, but just to keep it interesting.
See, I'm of the mind that it is a ghost story that just happens to have a murder mystery wandering through it. The movie is, it's an hour and 15 minutes. So for about an hour of that, you're watching the characters go, it's an old dark house type of movie, something like
it's a haunted house.
Yeah, something like The Cat and the Canary or The Old Dark House, if you've seen the James Whale film. So you're watching the two characters, predominantly Nora, played by Carolyn Craig, and Lance, played by Richard Long, wandering through this house, and occasionally stuff will happen that will cause Nora to freak out. There's always a quasi-rational explanation, but you are reminded repeatedly that this is a house where people have died.
It's very psychological horror. There's not necessarily the any of this could be plausible, any of it could be logically explained, but, you know, the poor Carolyn Craig character, how long before she snaps?
And much of that tries to tie tenuously to the murder part, that this is all an attempt to validate that the ghosts, if anything happens to any of the characters, if this married couple ends up killing each other, each one of them has plausible deniability. That works to a point. This is a movie for me that is fun in terms of watching the traps that are set by different characters. It's really just a litany of set pieces. So you have the wine cellar, you have this convenient vat of acid that supposedly is still works after all these years. They have bones that they throw in, and I like that. I like when William Castle is playing with what we expect of the old dark house film, where you have this very violent history. Considering that this comes at the end of the 1950s, and horror films would only get more explicit from here, this is a really fun blend of both. So let's talk about William Castle very briefly. Castle is the man of gimmicks. He's kind of the P.T. Barnum of horror films. Much like Val Lewton was able to create a lot of interesting films, get unique actors on a very short budget. And a lot of his films tended to have a gimmick associated with them, whether it was life insurance policies or having to sit in, the Coward's Corner, I think, during one of their films. This movie had something called Emergo, Which you would think would be some type of early 1950s 4D.
Such a great
name. Exactly. Everything ended in O. I think Percepto was one of them, too. There's a scene where a skeleton comes out and it's supposed to fly through the audience. It was the 1950s. Maybe they were easily amused. What do we think about watching this film now, sans gimmicks? You know, how does this movie hold up? Knowing that in a theater setting there was going to be something that was supposed to jump out at you, I don't think it really loses anything, because I doubt it would have worked for me in 1959.
And this is very much cinema of the 50s. You had the prevalence of 3D, you had what, smell-o-vision for a while. Castle's films work so implicitly well in kind of that era of gimmicks trying to keep up with television. I think it totally holds up. I'm exactly right with you, where I don't know if the skeleton would have worked on me as well. I would love to have seen how that looked, but I can't imagine it being amazing.
This is why it comes out at that end of the 1950s into the 1960s, when films would do this litany of gimmickry, whether it was, yeah, that brief foray into 3D, which dominated 1953, the 1960s would be dominated by the roadshow picture. Movies just got longer. You know, Castle taps into something. He made several films, but this was considered his second biggest film. This is often considered his best known film, even though he had done other things like Straight Jacket with Joan Crawford and The Tingler also with Vincent Price. What do we think it is about this film that makes it the best known? Is it because it's an old Dark House film? Is it because it's... I watched this alongside The Tingler the other day, and The Tingler is a cheese fest, a story of a doctor trying to discover the literal manifestation of fear, and it looks like a centipede on a string. Where I think this movie works better than The Tingler does is that The Tingler's trying to get deeper into the psychology. It's really trying to meld the scientific with the horrific. A lot similar to the stuff that David Cronenberg would come to perfect in the 1980s. This is a very simple story told very simply, and it just works. I think that's why it works better. Why do you think this is often considered Castle's best-known film?
For the big three that I always think of with Castle are, yeah, this one, 13 Ghosts, and The Tingler. Looking between the three of them, there's more points of identification. You've got some characters in there you can grab onto. It's more accessible.
Would you say that this is his best film?
Probably. It's been far too long since I've seen something like 13 Ghosts. I've been meaning to rewatch that for a while, and it's one that I haven't gotten to. But I would say for me, it's probably his best.
This is probably his second best. I tend to prefer one that not a lot of people are aware of, and that's Homicidal, which, if memory serves, was the attempt to emulate Psycho, which we'll talk about Psycho in a second. Homicidal is a fun gender-bending type of film, and it's very easy to see the similarities to something like Psycho. Oddly enough, Alfred Hitchcock was inspired to make Psycho because he saw how well House on Haunted Hill had done. So you see this really fun dialectic of inspiration, but I think Homicidal might be his better made film, if only because it has more interesting fun with the plot that we had just seen, if you've seen Psycho.
See, I'm gonna have to put that one on my list, because that's one I've actually never seen.
It's really, really interesting. We have to talk briefly about Ennis House, which is quote-unquote the house on Haunted Hill. I've always wanted to see Ennis House. It looks beautiful. It's a house in Los Feliz in LA, south of Griffith Park, designed by the acclaimed Frank Lloyd Wright in 1923. It was built in 24. It's the fourth and largest of Wright's textile block design. It looks like Legos made this house, because it's interlocking precast concrete bricks that's supposed to look like a Mayan temple, and it's the house on Haunted Hill. And I think that works really well. It had been done in other movies. It had been used as early as 1933 for the film Female, and it was used in 1975 for The Day of the Locust. Most people might know it from Blade Runner, but I always associate it with House on Haunted Hill because Even though the interiors are not Ennis House interiors, the outside is. But it's so ominous, and it looks so uninviting because it looks like a house made of Legos.
Well, and it's so different than so many movies you see, or houses you see in other movies like this. They so could have made the easy choice and just used your traditional haunted house. And that is just such a different, interesting looking house.
Let's talk briefly about the cast, because for a horror movie, this cast is really good. For the most part, there's a character that I find to be very annoying, but that's, I think, supposed to be intentional. So you have five core characters. You have Frederick Lauren, played by Vincent Price, his wife Annabelle, played by Carol Omart. You have Lance Schroeder, played by Richard Long, Nora Manning, played by Carolyn Craig, Elisha Cook Jr.'s Watson Pritchett, Dr. David Trent, played by Alan Marshall, and Ruth Bridgers, played by Julie Mitchum. Yes, related to Robert Mitchum. Really, though, there's only about five characters that you care about, necessarily. Dr. Trent and Ruth, what do we really know about them? One's a doctor, one's like a society head of hopper type. Is that your takeaway from those two?
Ruth especially is very throwaway, and yeah, the doctor, largely a plot device in my mind.
The doctor is expanded for reasons in the remake, which we'll touch on, but, and I say that this is why this seems like a murder mystery that just happened to wander into a horror film. This almost feels like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf just got lost in The Cat and the Canary, because you're introduced to Frederick and Annabelle. He's wealthy. She's just, quote unquote, a gold digger. You're supposed to at least assume that she's a gold digger. These two are squabbling throughout the entire movie. She doesn't want to go to the party. He tells her she has to go to the party. They're given guns as party favors. You're just waiting for one of these two characters to shoot each other. And I love how Vincent Price's character and her have these weird, it's almost like this weird sexual interplay between the two of them. He's always grabbing by the throat and pulling her hair. And I'm just sitting there thinking, these people are doing something freaky in their spare time.
Yeah. Such a fascinating dynamic to watch.
Watching it this time, I don't know if I necessarily see Carol Omart as a villain. We're not given much depth into their relationship before this movie's events, but she's the one sitting around saying, this isn't my party, this is all you, I don't want to hang out with these people. He's just needling her the entire movie, almost like he's driving her to insanity. I don't necessarily know if I believe that he isn't the one trying to create some villainy in her.
I'm so glad you said that, because I actually had a very similar reading this time through. So I was really looking at the relationships and the characters in this watching, and that was how I felt as well.
Carol Omart, I love. She was poised to be a Marilyn Monroe type, and
she stops in the 70s.
She was Miss Utah. She sang, she did television. She was dubbed a female Brando by the press in 1955. After she got married, she briefly retired from acting, but she ended up coming back. She starred in a couple other films. But she had a bit of a sticky personal life. She was married three times, divorced very quickly, and gave it all up. I had always heard that there were issues with her and her politics, but I can't find anything that proves that now, so I could completely be wrong. But I think she's very magnetic. She's got this regal bearing, got this very angular face, and you're never really sure what she's got planned. Now, mind you, she's a manipulator. There's no doubt about that. But the men in this movie are really stupid. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. You know, there's a scene where she's trying to play up to Lance. And we got to talk about Richard Long in this movie, because I find him to be hilariously, I'm pretty sure he'd be brought up on sexual harassment charges in this day and age. You know, she's playing up to like, oh, you're going to protect me. And he's like, sure. I find that most of these men in this film are very easily seduced by her, and it helps that she's gorgeous. But honestly, Lance has this thing with Nora. I just think he likes girl. You know, it doesn't really matter who it is.
She's the cute young secretary. Of course the test pilot has to go after the cute young secretary.
Yes, let's talk about Nora and Lance, otherwise known as the characters I wish weren't the leads in this movie. Carolyn Craig is sweet. She's unassuming. But she gives me nothing but screams. That's all she does in this movie. She's very, no, no, I'm being attacked. There's no real agency to her. She's very much a product of her time. And then you have Lance. Richard Long, he's probably best known to most people for Nanny and the Professor. He also did a couple Twilight Zone episodes, died young, unfortunately. He's very charismatic in that 1950s Pan Am type of way. You know, you could definitely see him piloting an airplane and definitely traveling with Carol Omart-esque flight attendants. I always say that my big issue with this film is that any relationship that's built in times of tragedy or fear are doomed to not be believable. Does anybody believe at the end of Speed that Keanu and Sandra Bullock are going to last past the credits? No, not really. And I think they mentioned that in the sequel. So here at the end, when Lance and Nora get together and it's like, oh, we've survived this and now we're really wealthy, I don't want them together. I find them both to be, she's annoying and way too timid. And he's definitely going to cheat on her. What do you think about these two as our de facto leads?
Like you said, he is that 1950s leading man. So I was kind of looking at how Man in the Gray Flannel Suit Vincent Price was. You know, he's so his own person. Richard Long just so belongs in this era. I hadn't thought of the Pan Am thing. That is such a perfect way to describe it. They're very 1959 cookie cutter characters. I think Nora is only in there. They needed a good girl to probably offset the Annabelle character.
And if you look at most old Dark House movies, oddly enough, in the early 30s, it used to be blondes, like Faye Ray in the old Dark House. And then as the 1940s and 1950s horror started to change, you got that glamorous Faye Ray type of character substituted for stuff like Paulette Goddard in The Cat and the Canary in the late 30s into the 1940s. Now you get more homely type of heroine. Nora, as a character, you mentioned she's the secretary. She's the girl you want to settle down with. And in contrast to Carol Omart's character, she doesn't need the money. I think she says that it's her and her mother. She lives with her mother. She's probably a professional virgin, to use a term from The Moon is Blue.
It's just, oh, what can she scream at? And it kind of felt bad for her in this viewing. Just looking at how much she gets put through in terms of all the other characters. It's...
Well, the other characters manipulate her because they can smell right away that she's weak. And it's funny, a couple of times Lance intentionally leaves her places and you're just thinking, maybe he's trying to get away from you. You bring up Vincent Price because I feel we can't just discuss him isolated in this film. As the 1950s progressed, Vincent Price became the king of horror. And it's a far cry from where he started out. Most people that I talk to about Vincent Price are very surprised that he was considered a respected actor back in the day. Going back and watching his films now as an adult and seeing how great he was as usually the other man. If you watch stuff like Laura or Leave Her to Heaven or Dragonwick, I keep bringing up the films that he made with Gene Tierney. He's playing very different types of characters, but the wrong man. That was what he was good at, was playing the wrong man, or in period pieces. 1953, he did House of Wax, which set everything in motion towards him being this horror actor. So then after that, he did The Fly, House on Haunted Hill, and The Tingler, and it just, that's what he became. What works about Vincent Price in this movie is that, and I can't say he did it in every movie, there's a seriousness. He takes the material seriously. He's not playing it with a wink and a smile like, I know this is beneath me. He's playing this like he's playing Sir Walter Raleigh in Elizabeth and Essex or The Song of Bernadette.
Looking through his filmography, just thinking about this stuff into the 1960s, you know, the very early Corman stuff, Pit and the Pendulum, and that is such a great way to look at his career. He played everything with that seriousness. He's one of my favorites. Back to Laura was probably my first introduction to his career.
And we have to talk about another actor who tends to fly under the radar, Elisha Cook Jr.
One of my favorite character actors.
He's a great character actor. It's remarkable that Elisha Cook Jr. doesn't get as much praise as someone like Vincent Price, because they both made a lot of movies. Elisha Cook Jr. always has that hangdog face. He was a very short character actor who became better known for noirs than he was horror. 217 credits to his name. I think that is insanely prolific. And he's great in everything. Everyone else is a skeptic. He is the one believer in the whole movie. He starts out a believer, he ends a believer. He comes in pretty much saying, y'all are gonna die here. This place is haunted, you should take it seriously. And everybody's just sitting around thinking, you're crazy. It's the one thing that I wish this movie had stuck to being a ghost story. Because the ending, which we're gonna spoil the ending, so if you don't want to know the ending to The House on Haunted Hill, you should fast forward. The ending of this movie culminates with Annabelle dying. Annabelle is trying to fake her death to make it look like she has died and that her husband has killed her so that Nora will kill him, and essentially Annabelle can walk away with the money. But the movie ends with Annabelle falling into that vat of acid. Story thing, if there's a vat of acid revealed in the film, by the end of it, somebody will end up falling in.
It will be used.
Annabelle falls into it, and you assume, okay, this is the ghost. No, it's really Frederick who did that. So the movie ends with poor Elisha Cook Jr. being, the ghosts are real, I'm telling you. It kind of undermines his character. You're left thinking, he's the one saying, there's ghosts, this place is definitely haunted. But we're never given any overt proof of that is not explained away by this murder mystery. That's the one thing that really irks me. And I'm not saying the remake did it better, because we'll talk about the remake, but that's the one thing that irks me about this movie. I wish they had given us some belief that maybe there were ghosts around. Something was not explained by this murder mystery. Everything is.
Thinking about that, he almost exists to sell that spooky environment. He's telling us it's spooky, ergo it must be spooky.
It's almost like he's William Castle, telling us there's definitely ghosts here, you're gonna be scared, and then when that doesn't happen, he reminds you, this is definitely scary. Let's talk really briefly about William Castle in the canon of films that he's made, and then we'll talk about the remake. William Castle films still work in a way in the modern era because there's usually a really fun story and there's good actors that are able to act in them. Even something that's chintzy that doesn't work, like The Tingler, or even something like Straitjacket. Straitjacket is a really fun movie because you got Joan Crawford and Diane Baker, two amazing actresses playing off of each other. I think in a lot of ways, even though his films eschew gore and violence, they still work because of the performers.
Vincent Price sells this movie. I would say, for me, it's a combination of Vincent Price and Elisha Cook Jr. in there. There are so many different levels. Watching it, this is probably the first time I've ever rewatched it and really paid attention to that relationship element, that quirky, kooky dynamic between Vincent Price and Carol Omert.
If you look at something like 13 Ghosts or I Saw What You Did or Macabre, Homicidal, he really likes to play with isolated groups of people, this makeshift family. Whether that's literal, as the case is with Homicidal or Straitjacket, or this invented family, which you see here. And I mean, a lot of old Dark House films are like that, but there's this element of trust and balancing who you can trust, what your preconceived notions are about the characters. I think that's a really underrepresented technique in his films. If you look at this in something like 13 Ghosts, 13 Ghosts has Margaret Hamilton in it, the Wicked Witch of the West. And the assumption immediately is that she's evil.
She has to be, because she's
exactly. And that doesn't end up playing out as people expect. The same thing goes here. To a lesser extent, people assume Nora is high strung, she's definitely going to kill somebody, and that plays out about as well as you can expect. But I like how he plays with those dynamics. You compare him to someone like Roger Corman, who went through that Grand Guignol type of phase that he did with Vincent Price and The Mask of the Red Death. Those films are operatic, but they can feel a bit cold, a little bit style over substance. Castle liked to play with gimmickry. If you watch The Tingler, there's a section of the film that's in bright red color. He played a little bit with technique, less so than Corman did. Corman loved to play with technique, throwing everything at the screen in terms of set design and all these moving parts. But the simplicity works better for Castle.
I was amazed when I was researching earlier. With Castle, I've always been very aware of his horror canon. I had no idea his career had started as early as it did. Working into the 30s, I believe, was when he started. And I had just discovered this weekend, Decades, was doing a marathon of Circle of Terror, a show he had created in the 70s. He was such a prolific filmmaker. To only know that probably 10-year stretch of films that he did in the 50s and 60s, it's kind of a shame.
William Castle is one of those where he was constantly looking for the next big score. And so a lot of his work tended to be a day late and a dollar short. So when he would make TV shows, they tended to emulate stuff that had been popular and then wasn't. There's a great documentary that's worth watching called Spine Tingler, the William Castle story that lays out his futile attempts to try to separate himself from the horror elements. Didn't always work as well as he had hoped. So let's talk about the remake. The remake was one of the first films to come out of the Dark Castle production company, which, if you've seen the remake of The Mummy that came out a couple months ago, you might have recalled Universal's attempt to do a dark universe. We tried this in the early 90s with Dark Castle, which was an attempt to take all the William Castle films and bring them in line with late 90s, early 2000s trends of horror. I think we got about two. And the fact that neither one made money pretty much put the nail in the coffin there. Pun intended. So you got a remake of 13 Ghosts in 2001, which I have not seen.
That makes me feel old.
Exactly. And then in 1999, you had a remake of House on Haunted Hill. This is the version that I saw when I first saw this movie. The plot is the same. You have a millionaire, this case, it's Jeffrey Rush, playing a character named Stephen Price, ha ha ha, because he's playing Vincent Price's character. He even has the mustache. I will say Jeffrey Rush is really good in this movie.
Jeffrey Rush is good in everything he does.
Unlike Vincent Price, he's playing it with a wink and a smile. He's not playing it with any level of seriousness. But he is an amusement park mogul who offers these people $1 million, because the price to stay in a haunted house has gone up with inflation, to spend the night in this haunted house. The murder element is still the same. This movie, though, ups not just the gore, but it also ups the ghost story. If you think that the original needed more of a ghost story, the remake does it on steroids. They have this B plot, because there's no denying that the Prices are trying to kill each other, but there are definitely ghosts. Because you have this subplot involving the house is this insane asylum for a doctor who was doing experiments on patients and then was viciously murdered. The opening scene of this movie is both incredibly intensely violent. There's a lot of creepiness in this movie, the way characters move, I don't like. That makes up for a lot of the failures of actually trying to remake House on Haunted Hill. But the cast, they include the doctor character. He has an expanded plot in the remake because we have to tie them in. It's fine. I don't think it's the worst movie I've ever seen. It's not the worst horror remake. But you watch this, and then you watch the original, and you get different elements of what you wanted the other one to have. So watching the remake in context of the original, it definitely has a ghost story. There's no denying that this house is haunted and the ghosts are there. But at the same time, it forsakes atmosphere for gore. We attempted something. I have not seen the remake of 13 Ghosts. I keep saying I'm going to at some point. This movie came out at the wrong time if they had any attempt of doing something with it. It came out the wrong time. It came out right around the same time as the remake of The Haunting from 99.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It was this, it was 13 Ghosts, and then The Haunting were all together.
Yeah, and you also had movies that attempted to do something similar. So you have like stuff like Ghost Ship in 2002.
Oh, that...
Which again, much like this movie, Ghost Ship starts out really well, and then you have the rest of the film.
That first scene is terrifying.
Exactly. But the remake of The Haunting is actually, I think the remake of House on Haunted Hill is way better than the remake of The Haunting. There was a real interest in trying to bring back these old horror movies with the belief that they weren't as good because they weren't as bloody.
Up the effects. We were starting to play with effects in the late 90s.
I will say that the remake of House on Haunted Hill doesn't have nearly as much overabundance of CGI as the remake of The Haunting does. But you lose those characters. Aside from Jeffrey Rush doing a Vincent Price imitation, the rest of the characters are stock. You can look at Carol Omart and you know her character in this movie. You look at Famke Johnson, she's great. There's not that same tone with the remake as there is in the original. That is going to do it for our episode on House on Haunted Hill. I feel like we undersold it. I recommend it a lot. I do enjoy it.
No, definitely.
I watch it every year. I find it to be really fun. The cast is game, which you always want with a horror film. It probably won't stand up compared to other horror films of the era. Even some of the other old Dark House films. I think stuff like The Old Dark House is a little bit better. This is still one of those landmark horror films that I think you need to see, even though it probably won't scare you. It's a great one to watch with friends, or watch the Riff Tracks version. They make a lot of jokes about Richard Long that make me happy, because apparently I'm not the only one that makes jokes about him. You can give me your thoughts on House on Haunted Hill or any Halloween movies that you enjoy from the classic era. You can email them to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and I'll read them on the next episode. I would like to thank Kimberly Pierce once again for joining me today. Kimberly, where can fans find and get in touch with you online?
Easiest place to find me, I'm on Twitter more than I should, at kpierce624. And you can find me also on geekgirlauthority.com.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to listen to episodes early or have me review your favorite film? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in learning more, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Next time, I do a special tribute episode to actress Veronica Lane with exclusive audio you won't hear anywhere else. Till next time, and have a safe and happy Halloween.